From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, the director, co-director, and co-writers of the Disney Pixar film Soul, which is nominated for an Oscar for Best Animated Film and won the Golden Globe in that category. We talk with Pete Docter and Kemp Powers. Soul's main character is a jazz musician who teaches middle school and is forced to confront the big question, what is the purpose of life? We'll hear about the turning points that led Docter and Powers to ask themselves that. Powers also has an Oscar nomination for his One Night in Miami screenplay, which he adapted from his play of the same name. It's about the conversation he imagines Malcolm X, Sam Cooke, Jim Brown, and Cassius Clay had the night they met in Miami after Clay won the heavyweight title in 1964, days before announcing he'd subsequently be known as Muhammad Ali. The movie Soul is nominated for 3 Oscars, including Best Animated Film. It already won the Golden Globe for Best Animated Picture. My guests are the director and co-director of Soul, Pete Docter and Kemp Powers. They co-wrote the film, too. Kemp Powers is also nominated for an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay for the film One Night in Miami, which he adapted from his play of the same name. Pete Docter wrote and directed Up and Inside Out, which won Oscars for Best Animated Film. He also wrote and directed Monsters, Inc. and co-wrote the screenplays for Toy Story, Toy Story 2, and WALL-E. He's now Chief Creative Officer at Pixar Animation Studios. Let's start with the movie Soul. It's about what makes a life meaningful and what makes us who we are. The main character, Joe Gardner, is a middle school band teacher who feels unfulfilled because his ambition is to be a full-time jazz musician. On the day he's offered a full-time teaching position, he learns of an opening in the band of a jazz legend Joe idolizes. He auditions and, to his amazement, gets the gig, which he thinks will be the beginning of his real life. He's so excited by this dream come true, he pays no attention to where he's walking and falls right into an open manhole. He's transported out of his body onto a conveyor belt to the great beyond, but he refuses to die just as he's about to get his big chance. So he runs in the opposite direction, falls off the conveyor belt into the land of the great before, where his body is in a holding pattern between life and death. Through a series of adventures and mishaps, he has to figure out the purpose of life before he can return to his body. In this scene from early in Soul, Joe Gardner, voiced by Jamie Foxx, is at the piano telling his middle school band students about how he fell in love with jazz when he was a child. The piano part is performed by John Batiste, who also composed and arranged the jazz sections of the score for Soul.
Look, I remember one time my dad took me to this jazz club, and that's the last place I wanted to be. But then I see this guy, and he's playing his chords with force on it. And then with a minor, I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Then he has the inner voices, and it's like he's singing. And I swear, the next thing I know, it's like he floats off the stage. That guy was lost in the music. He was in it, and he took the rest of us with him. And I wanted to learn how to talk like that. That's when I knew I was born to play. Connie knows what I mean. Right, Connie?
I'm 12.
I love that. Pete Docter, Kemp Powers, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the Oscar nominations and on the win from the Golden Globes. Pete, you originated the story of Soul. What was the germ of the idea?
Well, I started working on it after Inside Out, and it was a kind of a period of some amount of emotional turbulence, and I had always loved animation. You know, I was 9, I think, when I made a flipbook and figured out this is what I want to do with my life. And having just finished Inside Out and so much success in the film, I found myself wondering, why don't I feel like my life is all wrapped up and solved in a nice bow? Why didn't it fix everything? And maybe I've been pouring my efforts and focus into the wrong thing. So this film was really an investigation into what's going on in my life, what's going on in the world, and what's life all about.
So why did you make the main character a jazz musician?
Yeah, we experimented with a couple different things. For a while, Joe was an actor, and we found what happened was that the audience, for whatever reason, thought he just wanted fame. So it was just like a selfish goal. But with music, especially jazz music, you know, you don't go into jazz to get rich and famous. You do it because you have this passion and drive to perform this kind of music. There's something that felt noble about it. And then as we learn more about it, jazz as a metaphor for life was just too good to pass up in terms of what we were trying to say in the film.
How did you decide to collaborate with Kemp Powers on the film?
Well, we had made some of these decisions of Joe being a jazz musician, being living in New York. We figured, okay, if this is a film about a jazz musician, our main character should probably reflect that. That seems like the right thing to do. We need some help. We need people who, somebody, ideally it would be a major contributor, the writer, who knows about those things. And so we were really lucky to find Kemp, who not only is all those things, but also is a damn good writer.
Yeah, so does this part get a little awkward, or like you realize you need a black person working on the screenplay with you, and Kemp, you realize when you're called that like you're the black person who's going to help them with it. It's like, I think we recognize that that is what needs to be done, but I think it's like an awkward position for everybody. Like, how do you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, it is pretty funny because obviously when I got the call from my agent that Pixar was interested, they were looking for a writer to help them with a project, and they're always very cloak and dagger about it. So they wouldn't tell me anything about what the story was about. But of course, the first thing my brain said was, I'm guessing the story must have black people in it. And and you know, it's I try not to be. I know that can sound cynical, but look, that's just the reality of this business, this industry, and that it wasn't very long ago. And when I say not very long ago, I'm talking just like 3 or 4 years ago, where it was very possible if you happened to be white to create and tell a story about anything you wanted to. And no one would so much as push you to even consult with people from that community, let alone invite them in and be partners. So while, you know, it's easy to kind of take the cynical route, I saw it more as a really interesting opportunity, because when I flew up to Pixar and I sat down and I saw the nuggets of what would become Soul, I really fell in love with the story that Pete was trying to tell. And it was a story that felt like it was about me, you know, and it was a story that really wasn't about race. Yes, Soul is a film. The majority of the characters are black, but it's not, quote unquote, a black film. It's this, we're trying to tell this universal story through the specific prism of a black man. And I think that was a really bold choice that I was relishing an opportunity to try to execute.
Were there changes you wanted to make as soon as you started working on it?
Yeah. I mean, that's. I think that's part of what probably you have to confirm with Pete. I'm sure that's part of what got me hired, is that they showed me a reel. It was about 45 minutes long, and I had notes. I mean, I had a lot of thoughts, and there were definitely questions I had about basically this main character, Joe. I think the way I described it, Pete, correct me if I'm wrong, was that in the early reels, he seemed like the least interesting person in the film.
Yeah, it was an interesting concept, but not Joe.
Yeah, Joe just, and part of it was, I think, because there had been such extreme caution and such a fear of doing things that might, you know, offend someone or upset someone, that instead there really hadn't been much done. Like, I didn't know anything about the guy. I didn't really know anything about his family. I didn't know. It seemed like Joe was just a very, very lonely man who didn't know anyone and had no friends. And so that just meant that his life had to be filled in. And of course, just the nature of being at Pixar is that it doesn't matter whether you're a director or a designer or an artist, you use your life as fuel. So it was very easy for me when you say, oh, he's supposed to be a 45-year-old black man from New York. What a coincidence. That's what I am. To start filling in a lot of those gaps with my own personal experiences.
So what is one of those gaps that you filled in with your own personal experience?
It was honestly the first scene I started working on when I came there. And it's a scene we call it, I think the scene is called Suit. And it's when Joe goes to get a suit from his mom, who is a tailor. And a lot of elements of the discussion they have between his mom, who's played by Felicia Rashad Libba, is really just a versions of conversations I've had with my own mother about, like, how long are you going to continue to pursue this writing thing? Pursuing writing as a career can really seem like a fool's errand to people, and understandably so when you consider the likelihood of having any kind of success at it. And so as you get into your 30s and then get into your 40s and you still haven't made very much of a dent, a concerned parent is going to really tell you about those concerns.
So we happen to have this scene queued up and ready to go. So let's hear it. So this is Joe, the jazz musician, and his mother who runs the tailor shop.
Mom, I know we've had some rough times, but you're right. I can't be truthful with you because it seems like no matter what I do, you disapprove.
Look, I know you love playing.
Then how come except for church, you're the happiest when I don't? I finally land the gig of my life and you're upset.
You didn't see how tough being a musician was on your father. I don't want to see you struggle like that.
So Dad could pursue his dreams and I can't?
Your father had me. Most times, this shop is what paid the bills. So when I'm gone, who's gonna pay yours?
Music is all I think about. From the moment I wake up in the morning to the moment I fall asleep at night.
You can't eat dreams for breakfast, Joey.
Then I don't want to eat. This isn't about my career, Mom. It's my reason for living. And I know Dad felt the same way. I'm just afraid that if I died today, that my life would have amounted to nothing.
Joey.
So, Kim Powers, what was the version of that conversation you had with your mother?
It was several conversations, and the last part where he says, if I die today, I feel like my life would have amounted to nothing. That was something I was saying to myself a few years before when I almost died in a hospital. And I had gotten very, it was right before the opening in Baltimore of my play one night in Miami, ironically enough. And I'd had an allergic reaction to Tamiflu and ended up coming down with rhabdomyolysis. It's basically your muscles start dissolving and it causes your organs to shut down. And I ended up in the hospital in Baltimore for more than a week. And there was a great concern that everything, that my organs were all going to fail. And I was surrounded by my loved ones, you know, and family. And I was just, I couldn't move because I was in such pain. I was heavily medicated for the pain. So I was just spent most of the day staring out a window. And I just, this malaise fell over me. And I just was saying to myself over and over again, like, oh man, like it's like I won't, it's like I've never even, I didn't accomplish anything. Like it's like I wasn't even here. Like no one's even going to remember that I was here. And I said to myself that, like, oh, if I make it out of this, then I'm going to like go for broke. And it was when I got out of that hospital a few weeks later, that I basically turned around and I was still doing journalism, as contract work, that I quit my last journalism job and said, I'm not available anymore to do any contract work. I'm really going to kind of pursue this foolish dream of mine of doing my creative writing by going all in. And, you know, for my mom, it's one of those things where, like, being a writer all these years, it's embarrassing. You know, you go, you're married, you end up getting divorced, you have kids, and you're getting older and older and still having to go to your mom to, like, borrow money. Because every time there's a big opportunity and you talk about it with such excitement, ultimately something always ends up happening that makes that opportunity not be as lucrative, as fruitful as you expect it to be. It's funny because my mom she called me up a couple of weeks ago. She was pretty upset with me because when we won the Golden Globe for Soul, I hadn't told her. Because I've gotten into the habit of not bringing up what I'm doing anymore, just because of so many years of always saying, I've got this thing. And it never, and so my mom was like, a friend of mine calls me up and says, congrats to your son. He won the Golden Globe. And she's like, you know, I had to pretend like I knew what she was talking about. So, yeah, it's,
well, I hope you told her about the Oscar nominations, plural.
I believe she knows now.
Okay, good. So I want to get back to the conceit of Soul. Pete, one of the things you had to do is to figure out what is the afterlife or the limbo that your main character was going to be in when he has this near-death experience and he's holding on for life. And it's really unclear whether he's going to live or survive. So you had to figure out this whole kind of system of what happens to bodies in limbo. So did you talk to people who had near-death experiences? And I should ask here, Kemp, did you have a near-death experience when you were in the hospital, in the kind of predicament that you had just described, where all of your organs might be failing as a result of the allergic reaction you were having?
I mean, it felt like a near death in that, I wasn't in a coma. I was awake, but I couldn't move physically. And it was a situation where the only way they can treat rhabdomyolysis is flushing your body with water. So I was hooked up to several IVs. They were monitoring my heart to make sure that it didn't drown my heart and cause it to stop. And then it was just a matter of time. It was either the process was going to start reversing itself or it wouldn't. And so it was kind of like, is this slow death or not? It definitely felt like a near-death experience living through it. And, you know, it took me quite a while to recover from that. Like, I wasn't able to really walk at full speed for a period of months because of the muscle loss. And I think the hospital said that it was one of the worst cases they'd ever seen at that hospital. So it absolutely felt that way.
Did you feel like your life force was being drained?
I mean, yeah, I felt like I was. There were days the right before, full disclosure, like right before things started to improve, I was starting to write letters to my children. Like, okay, I guess I better explain to these two kids why I'm not going to be around anymore.
So to bring that back to the movie, was there anything you drew on from that experience that you wanted to put into the character of Joe, who desperately wants to live but knows he might not?
Well, the scene where when Joe falls through the manhole cover and he's looking into the light and he turns around and is like, no effing way. Man, that spoke to me. And in fact, I think, remember, Pete, like when we got into animation, I kept on pushing for us to make Joe even more adamant about, like, there is no damn way I am going into that light, to the point where he's shoving people out of his way, because that was absolutely how I felt. But no, I think it was what Pete was going for was just tapping into something that I knew from experience and knew from having felt it. I mean, this character's journey, it's interesting. In our society, whether people mean to do it or not, I feel like we're all broken up into winners and losers. That's really how it feels. It feels like we're told that based on the decisions that we make, we're all going to end up being a winner or being a loser. But increasingly, it seems like the thing that makes a person a winner is akin to like winning the lottery. It's something that's almost impossible. So it feels like almost no one actually gets to be a winner. But it's not about winners or losers, and that everyone's life has value. And that's something that really, really spoke to me immensely as someone who, and I think it speaks to a lot of creatives, because creatives are notoriously a group that suffer from imposter syndrome. And so that was really a powerful driving force for me.
Well, let me reintroduce you both. If you're just joining us, my guests are Pete Docter and Kemp Powers, the director and co-director of the film Soul, which has an Oscar nomination for Best Animated Film. Powers is also nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay for One Night in Miami. We'll be right back after a break. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc. Teladoc offers access to licensed therapists by phone or video to help those dealing with stress, anxiety, personal, or family issues. Teladoc is committed to quality, confidential therapy from the comfort of your home, available 7 days a week, matching members to therapists, counselors, and psychiatrists. Teladoc therapy is available through most insurance or employers, and individual plans are also available. Download the app or visit teladoc.com/freshair to get started today.
Well, let's get back to talking about the film Soul. Since Soul is so much about what happens when you're between life and death and what happens in the afterlife and the before life, I'd love to hear the stories you were each told about what happens when you leave this world or when you're in that kind of limbo state. Pete, let's start with you.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up Lutheran, and so understanding kind of the concepts of God and heaven and so on. But I think, you know, as a kid, you have these very specific, I guess you want to put visuals to them, right? You want to visualize what does that look like. And then when you go back now as an adult and read the same, you know, the Bible and so on, it's not very well spelled out. If you're looking for answers, there's almost more questions there, which I think is kind of the intention of it, to make you think and really engage in it. The more research we did on this film, it's almost like my brain expanded to allow for the possibility of these things. I don't think I came up with any specific concrete answers. It's more that I was able to think more broadly.
That's an interesting result of making the movie.
Yeah, it was a great experience to be able to come into work every day and basically ruminate and think about and meditate on this theme of like, what's life about? And of course, that's really beyond trying to describe any cosmological or theological system or whatever. It was really more looking and separating the differentiation between passion and purpose, you know, and those became big controlling ideas in the film that we kept circling around trying to define.
What is the difference the way you see it?
As someone who feels as though I have this purpose in life, which is to create animated films, well, no, that's my passion. It's what I love doing, right? But I think a lot of times you end up mistaking that this is what I was born to do. In fact, we ended up putting that in the film that Joe feels. He says, I'm a musician. This is what I was born to do. But those are different things, right? The idea that your purpose in life has something to do with your passion, it could be, but I think it's broader than that.
Well, he's even told when he's in this state of limbo that the spark, the thing that you're passionate about, isn't your soul's purpose. And the meaning of that is he's basically told if you let your obsession take over, you lose your sense of meaning. You lose your sense of purpose.
Yeah, we had this great element in the film that we discovered, these lost souls. So this is, I won't get into the specifics, you'll have to see the film, but there are these characters, these creatures that sort of are like haunted, wandering the astral plane, disconnected from life. And for people like myself who have this intense passion, that can be just as isolating. That could be just as lost to be completely absorbed by something. And I think in its best case, in its best incarnation, something like music or storytelling, film, it connects you to life. It reminds you how interconnected everything is and how this is why you had to make a movie about it instead of me talking about it. But, you know, the idea that when you walk out into the world and you smell the air and you hear birds and you taste and touch and all those things, that's, I think, what ultimately we really want from life is this reminder that we're not alone, that we're all connected and part of something bigger than just our little puny bodies.
So I want to get back to something you were saying, Pete, that that obsession can block out a lot of things that are very important about life, that the work that you do, no matter how passionate you are, isn't the total meaning of life, and it can block out some of the meaning and some of the beauty of life. So, Kemp, when you were emerging from this near-death experience in which you had that awful allergic reaction, and you had promised yourself that if you survived, you're going to go all in and try to do the kind of writing you really wanted to do instead of journalism, where you felt you weren't really making any progress in your career. So did you become very obsessive about that? And did you get to the point where you felt like you were shutting out parts of life?
Oh, absolutely. Something that we discussed when making this film was that at different points in our lives and careers, we feel like we've all been lost souls, based on our definition of it, because look, when you find something you enjoy and you're passionate about and you actually are pretty good at it, it is so easy to take the extra step of hiding behind that thing and using it to not deal with so many other elements of life. That's why it was so important that when we introduced the idea of the lost soul, that someone could be lost, but then they could be found, that they could come out of it. That it was a state of mind, a state of being that characters in the film could go back and forth between. Because, I don't want to speak for Pete, but I've definitely found myself, based on our own definition of it, a bit of a lost soul. Someone who, you know, to avoid facing all different elements of life, just losing myself in my work. And it becomes that much easier, like I said, when you start having a little success at it. So it gives you an even more of an excuse to just stay there all the time.
And Pete, you know, you were talking about some of the things you opened your mind to in making this movie. Did you also feel like, gee, maybe I should take more pleasure in just like little things in life, like falling leaves and the taste of pizza?
Yeah, no, and it sounds kind of trite and small to say, but it's absolutely true. In a sense, I think as an artist, I keep a sketchbook. When I draw, there is some connection made because of that attention that I could have walked past a building for years, but if I stop and draw it, then I'm suddenly aware of all this detail and specific stuff that would have completely, I would never have observed before, you know. So there's something about the act of drawing that I think is kind of a spiritual connection in there as well.
Yeah, and it's no longer just like background. It's something that you can immerse yourself in and appreciate the details of.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, working on this film was really, and I think this is true of any story, when you get to turn things around and say, okay, if Joe believes he's like an essentialist, you know, if the philosophical school of thought of like, I was born with this purpose, then you get to start playing around with what's the flip side of that. Maybe there's a nihilist in the film who believes there's no meaning at all to anything. Or, you know, that's kind of our character that Tina Fey plays, is this, she thinks life is meaningless, although that turns out to be somewhat of a surface level, of like a way of dealing with her inner fear that she's not good enough, which I think is something else that a lot of us have, this worry that unless I perform up to a certain level, unless I make these accomplishments and achievements, then really I don't deserve it. I'm not good enough.
Yeah, I think we can all relate to that.
Yeah, and I feel like the movie's aim is really to say that we're already enough. You know, we all deserve, and we all can walk out of the door and enjoy life without needing to accomplish or prove anything. And that's really freeing, I think.
And that's not to say that we don't think people should have dreams, because it's very easy for people to take that message and assume that we're saying you shouldn't have dreams. And that was never the case.
No.
You're not saying just enjoy the pizza and the falling leaves.
No, but do, you know, yeah.
But do, yeah. Okay. Let me reintroduce you. If you're just joining us, my guests are Pete Docter and Kemp Powers, the director and co-director of the film Soul, which they also co-wrote. It's nominated for 3 Oscars, including Best Animated Film. Powers is also nominated for an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay for One Night in Miami, which he adapted from his play of the same name. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Indeed.com. Indeed.com, the hiring site that helps you find quality candidates with Indeed Instant Match. Indeed searches through the millions of resumes in their database to help show you great candidates. Indeed gives you full control and payment flexibility, delivering a quality shortlist faster. There are no long-term contracts, and you can pause your account at any time. Right now, receive a $75 credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/fresh air. Terms and conditions apply.
On NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, we talk about what we're watching, listening to, or just trying to figure out, like what concert films you should watch if you miss live music, and great books to read alone or in your book club. All of that in around 20 minutes every weekday. Listen now to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
Let's get back to my interview with Pete Docter and Kemp Powers, who directed and co-directed the film Soul, which has received an Oscar nomination for Best Animated Film. Powers has a nomination for Best Adapted Screenplay for One Night in Miami, which he adapted from his play of the same name. Kemp Powers, I want to ask you about One Night in Miami, because in addition to the Best Animated Film Oscar nomination, you're nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay for One Night in Miami, which is adapted from your play of the same name. And it's about the night that Muhammad Ali won the heavyweight championship, defeating Sonny Liston. And then there was a gathering in the Hampton House Motel of Cassius Clay, Malcolm X, Sam Cooke, and Jim Brown, as a football player. You know, you've written this whole dialogue for them, this whole conversation in which they talk about, like, the great issues facing them as individuals and facing the civil rights movement and, you know, the more radical black movement that Malcolm X is a part of. How much did you actually know about what happened when they all got together?
Honestly, just little tidbits in terms of the actual discussion in the room. There, I mean, if you read biographies on each of the four men, if you read enough of them like I have, there will be references to details of that night, them being in quiet conversation, them just having vanilla ice cream to eat, which is a detail that I put into the film script. But it was really less about, I mean, when I wrote it, I wanted to really position this more as historical fiction, because it was really less about what they actually said that night to me and more about what each of these men represented. And the discussion that I wanted these characterizations of them to have is a discussion that black men have been having since way before that night and are still having to this day, black people in general. And it's what, if any, social responsibility does a black public figure have, whether it be a black athlete, a black politician, a black singer, a black artist? What if any, public responsibility do you have? And it just so happened that these four men represent very clear, very distinct ideas about how much or how little you have. And again, when I first found out that this was a real night, my intention was to write a book about their friendship. So I went down this path of doing years of research to write a book that I never got around to writing. And then as my career in journalism ended and my creative writing career picked up, the very thing that had stymied me from writing the book, which was not being able to fill in that blank, was really the perfect setup for what initially was a stage play to debate these things with, like I said, characterizations based on everything that I really knew about each of the four men.
How have you answered the question you posed for yourself, like how much of your work should be in service of the larger movement?
Well, for me, I think I never don't think about personal and social responsibility. It's never not on my mind. And in terms of how much, it's very situational. That's why when I wrote that film, I didn't want an audience to come away from it feeling like the central argument, so to speak, is between Malcolm X and Sam Cooke. And I didn't want audiences to leave feeling that one person was necessarily right and the other person was necessarily wrong, because the answer is very situational. I think that in order for us to, as a people, to get where we need to be, we need both Sam Cooks, which means people who are willing to suffer and work within the system to bring about change that you might not immediately see, but that's change that's happening. And then you also need Malcolm X's, people who are willing to confront the problem publicly and burn the whole system down and start over if need be. There's very different tactics. And I think that their debate is in many ways an internal monologue. It's the debate that goes on inside my psyche now that I'm a very public artist. It's a debate that happens before I decide which projects I'm going to take on, which things I want to really commit myself to. And I think it was I'm really happy that the play version of that story was actually one of the couple of things that Pete and the folks at Pixar read before they brought me on to Soul, because I felt like, okay, if they've read One Night in Miami, they should know that I'm going to really be speaking up if there are issues that I find objectionable about certain elements of characterization.
Pete, what did you find relevant in One Night in Miami to Soul?
I just felt like Kemp's ability to take these themes and argue both sides of it was exactly what we were looking to do in the film, and portray them through such strongly opinionated and clear characters, you know, because of course those, the characters are the voice of the author, and in all these things is like the audience experiences it through those characters, and they were just so cleanly and clearly defined. It was really great. I think we read the play version, because of course the film one you hadn't even started writing it, had you?
I turned in the first draft the week I started at Pixar.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, it wasn't done yet.
It's kind of interesting that One Night in Miami and the U.S. versus Billie Holiday and Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, three Oscar-nominated movies, are all based on real people. And there seems to be kind of a trend of a lot of African-American-themed films being about real events in history or real people, you know, including yours, One Night in Miami. And I'm wondering, like, if you have any thoughts about why that is.
I was wondering that one myself. Maybe it's universal consciousness. I'm assuming a lot of it probably has to do with Trump's presidency. I was having a conversation with another black filmmaker about this fairly recently, and just this idea that it feels like as a nation we're going through such a moment of crucible change. So it's pretty easy to, you know, look at other moments of crucible change in our own nation's history, and the 60s in particular really jump out, because first, like, you know, we're so familiar with so many of these people, so many of them are our heroes and our icons, but there's also always lessons to be learned from their experiences, and in some cases lessons that it's very evident that we have not learned as a country, you know. And that's not to say that we haven't had progress. Of course, we've had incredible, you know, progress. The night that One Night in Miami took place, Miami was still segregated. These men actually had to stay in the black part of town. They didn't have a choice. So it's not to say there hasn't been immense progress, but it does point out just how bad things can get when the pendulum swings in the other direction. And it does feel like there have been some massive pendulum swings. And then the last presidency, I think this is just my theory, maybe got artists kind of examining that a little bit more. But remember, I first wrote the play back in 2013. So this predated, you know, Black Lives Matter, and it predated all these movements. It's really hard to say.
Well, good luck to both of you at the Oscars, and thank you so much for talking with us. It's just been a pleasure.
Oh, it's been great to be here.
Thank you. It was fun.
Thank you.
Pete Docter and Kemp Powers co-wrote the film Soul, which Docter directed and Powers co-directed. Soul is nominated for an Oscar for Best Animated Film. Powers is also nominated for an Oscar for his One Night in Miami screenplay, which he adapted from his play of the same name. This is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Sattva, the comfort company. Sattva luxury mattresses are made in America by expert craftsmen using the highest quality materials so that your mattress will provide comfortable sleep for years and years. Sattva mattresses are always delivered to your home and set up in the room of your choice. They're never folded and never squeezed into a small box. Visit SAATVA.com/NPR, where NPR listeners save an additional $225. Sattva, the comfort company.
On NPR's Consider This podcast, we don't just catch you up on the news. We help you make sense of what's happening, whether it's how to tackle the challenges that come with pregnancy during a pandemic or how to understand the crisis unfolding along our southern border. We'll fill you in for 15 minutes every weekday. Listen now to Consider This from NPR.
We've all heard the phrase, the unexamined life is not worth living. But what about the overly examined life? Can thinking too much drain the pleasure out of life? Our book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Life of the Mind, a wry debut novel that mulls over those very questions and more.
The opening scene of Christine Smallwood's sharp debut novel called The Life of the Mind finds her main character, Dorothy, locked into the stall of a public bathroom. Dorothy spends a lot of time locked in bathrooms. She's having a prolonged miscarriage, which means there are long intervals every day when she's sitting and thinking on the toilet. By profession, Dorothy is a thinker. She's a graduate student in literature, stuck, as she acknowledges, in adjunct professor hell. She teaches up to 4 courses a semester at an elite university, all the while trying and failing to make progress on her dissertation, which appropriately happens to be about female confinement and the Gothic novel. Here's Dorothy ruminating over her stuck position in life. Last fall, there had been 6 job openings in her field. This fall, there had been none. The hiring climate had dried into a dust bowl. She couldn't go on like this, she knew. But she couldn't not go on. She vaguely recalled a time when wanting to do the job she had trained for did not feel like too much to want. Now want itself was a thing of the past. She lived in the epilogue of wants. The Life of the Mind is about endings that dribble to a close, the inexorable erosion of dreams, the slow leak of youthful buoyancy. It's about being youngish at a time in history when it feels like many things might be fading away, including the natural world. The great accomplishment of Smallwood's taut novel is that while it is indeed about all those grim subjects, it's also one of the wittiest, most deliciously farcical novels I've read in a long time. Much of the humor here is rooted in the claustrophobic world of academia, where everyone vies to be the big fish in a shrinking and unsustainably fetid pond. Dorothy had once been a rising star, thanks to a published essay on Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca. But after a decade in grad school, she's gone stale, even as she can't imagine what else to do. Which brings us to the extended comic highlight of this novel, the academic conference. Smallwood's genius is to take this professional ritual of cutthroat networking and jargon-encrusted performative presentations and set it in Las Vegas. If a career in academia, especially in the humanities, is a crapshoot, what better site for a conference than this landscape of slot machines, an empty spectacle? Dorothy, as ever, tries hard to have a smart take on Las Vegas, yet the city's pleasure-loving mindlessness defeats her. At the interminable conference, Dorothy runs into her dissertation advisor, a manipulative diva who's the reason why Dorothy has sought out the services of not one, but 2 therapists simultaneously, one of whom, of course, has a podcast. Dorothy also stumbles into her old grad school boyfriend, who, when they were together, had a kinky predilection for whispering Frank O'Hara poems into, well, not her ear. As I once heard the mystery novelist and humorist Lisa Scottolini say, if it doesn't make you wince, it's not funny. Wince-inducing moments thicken the pages of Smallwood's inventive novel. So too do literary allusions. A degree in the humanities may not be enough to get Dorothy a tenure-track job, but it's undeniably helpful in terms of getting some of the jokes here that involve references to Samuel Beckett and George Eliot's Middlemarch and the work of one of America's first doomsday prophets, Jonathan Edwards. The life of the mind isn't anti-intellectual. It doesn't disparage Dorothy's erudition acquired by years of hard work, and it certainly doesn't exalt the vacuity of Vegas as a symbol of happiness. Instead, the novel takes aim at the kind of reflexive, critical thinking that's never turned off. Dorothy overanalyzes everything from doorknobs to stuffed animal toys and makes herself, to paraphrase Hamlet, sick with thought. If only she could learn to laugh sometimes, as this vastly entertaining novel of ideas encourages us readers to do. Her narrow world might expand.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Life of the Mind by Christine Smallwood. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, my guest will be Reuben Jonathan Miller, author of the new book Halfway Home, Race, Punishment, and the Afterlife of Mass Incarceration. His new book is part memoir. His father and brothers have been incarcerated, and Miller spent 4 years in foster care. But it's also a sociological study. He spent years following the lives of men and women after they're released from prison and face hundreds of policies and laws that restrict the jobs they're allowed to hold, where they're allowed to live, and more. He teaches at the University of Chicago. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Chaloner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our associate producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.